his bill.
Good morning. I'd like to bring the House Committee on General Government Consumer Protection into session on Tuesday, May 10th, 2011. Have a modest agenda today, and I think we will start out with Senate Bill 957 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 957. Jan, could you give us a description?
Senate Bill 957, it directs the Department of Justice to deposit monies that are received from state officers and agencies for services that are provided by the department into a subaccount of the Department of Justice operating account, and then allows the department to transfer from the subaccount to the general fund any money that's not needed. There are no amendments, there's no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Thank you. And if we could have Keith Dubanovich come forward and explain to us why we need this bill.
Good morning, Chair Hulvey, Chair Wisnant. My name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. This bill is frankly one of the simplest bills that I have the pleasure of presenting to you. But of all things, it's a bit of an oddity that we have to ask permission to give you money back. In essence, from time to time, the Department of Justice, like other state agencies, does not go through all of the funds that you allot to us through general funds. And at the end of the two-year biennium, you sometimes take that money back, as you most likely will this year. But for us to do that midstream or before you convene on your biennial sessions, we don't have the authority to give you any of that money back. And through efficiencies and through hard work, we tend to save money from time to time. And since you've allocated that money, we think we ought to be allowed to give it back to you so that you can allot it to other uses. But we cannot do that without statutory authority, and that's what Senate Bill 957 will do. Simply give us the authority to give back to you the money that we do not need to use to represent the people of the state of Oregon. So with that, I am happy to answer any of your questions.
Questions from the committee? So, Mr. Dubanovich, I don't see any questions. What did you do with the money before?
Periodically, you would sweep it at the end of the session, but to be honest, like most other agencies, we ended up just trying to spend it because there was nothing else we could do with it. Historically, if you did a survey of most state agencies, they ended up just spending whatever is allocated to them.
Well, I appreciate you coming forward with an efficiency bill that looks like it might help the state out a little bit. What do you foresee in the amount of money that you give back?
Chair Hulvey, that's certainly going to vary from year to year. We already have a couple of efficiency proposals that we hope will save us, you know, $100,000 here, maybe $10,000 there. I know we're working on something in our child support program that we're estimating is going to save us $40,000. So it's not necessarily enormous money, but if you total it all up over the course of a couple of year period, you know, certainly if we can return a few $100,000 or $1 million to you, why not?
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the attitude. Every penny counts in these days, as you know, so I really appreciate the Attorney General bringing this bill forward. Any other discussion? Not seeing any. Thank you very much,
you.
Mr. Dubanovich. And no one else came to testify on this bill. I think I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 957 and open a work session on 957.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 957 to the floor, but do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 957 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, could we have a vote, please, Tamara?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Co-Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hulvey.
Aye. Senate Bill 957, having received the required votes, is passed by the floor. Representative Clem, would you like to carry this bill?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 957 and open a... Let's go down the list. Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 530. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 530?
Mr. Chairs, committee members, this is the bill that changes the name of the Commission on Asian Affairs to the Commission on Asian and Pacific Islander Affairs. The committee adopted the Dash 1 amendment earlier this month, which restored trade opportunities to the list of items on which the commission would compile information on. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact, and that is it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 530 to the floor. We do pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 530 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Actually, outlet native on there.
Seeing none, Tamara, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Clem?
Yes.
Representative Conger?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Commissioner Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 530, having received required votes, is passed to the floor. Do I have a volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
Okay.
Representative Smith, thank you.
Representative Wisnett's on it now, too.
I could carry it if you'd like.
That's fine if you want to.
Representative Wisnett? Well, Representative Wisnett will carry the bill. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 530. And let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 151. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 151?
Mr. Chair and committee members, this bill expands and clarifies the Housing and Community Services Department's authority regarding use of monies in the Housing Development and Guarantee account, and it authorizes the department to set interest rates on loans made from the account. There were no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 151 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 151 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I might ask somebody from the Housing and Community Services Department to come forward at this moment in time.
That would be splendid.
So, just wanted to have a short discussion about the bill so that the committee understands. Understands it a little bit better before we send it onto the floor. And I don't know if anybody else has questions, but can you just tell us a little bit about why we're doing this bill as far as raising that amount?
So this particular bill, for the record, I'm Lisa Joyce, Policy and Communication Manager for Oregon Housing and Community Services. This particular bill, probably the most significant part of it, is that it clarifies what the department can do with monies that are appropriated to that account. We've been working on informal advice from our Attorney General that permits us to do what we've been doing with this resources, and this will just clarify that what our current practice is clearly stated in law. The other thing that's important about this particular piece of legislation is that we have been unable to offer low-interest loans from this account. We've been tied to a T-bill rate that's very high, and affordable housing can't pencil out with that higher interest rate. We want to be able to offer those low interest rate loans and then be able to recycle those resources, so make them go farther instead of having to just grant them.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification to remind us what this bill is. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you're up testifying, I appreciate for the committee, because the last meeting and you clarified it very well, you and Rick in my office, about I was concerned about the statement paying for costs to develop nonprofit organizations. So for the record, maybe just a couple of comments on how you...
Chair Holvey, Chair Wisnant. The question that you had raised was, what do we do with the resources that are devoted to developing the capacity of nonprofit organizations that deliver affordable housing? And what we've done is, for example, our most recent use of those dollars for this particular purpose was to increase the capacity of one of our nonprofit agencies to assist in the purchase of manufactured dwelling parks by cooperatives so that the tenants can then become the owners of their community. It required them to develop some legal capacity and some bring some staff on, and that was what we did with those resources.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee on this bill? Just wanted to see if we had some clarity about what this bill does. Mm-hmm. Not seeing any. Ms. Joyce, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
So I believe we have a motion before us. Any other discussion from the committee? Seeing none, Tamara, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Cameron?
Excused.
Representative Flynn?
Yes.
Representative Calder?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Vice Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 151, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. Volunteer to carry this particular bill. Representative Conger, thank you. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 151. Quickly running through the list.
I called his office and got lost in the phone maze.
Now, open a. Actually, let's stand at ease for a few minutes.
Try again.
Bring them both up together.
I'll reconvene the House Committee on General Government, Consumer Protection, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 85. Jan, could you give us a description of Senate Bill 85?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. It gives the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services the authority to issue cease and desist order and gives investigatory authority related to the regulation of sale of the manufactured structures. And it requires manufactured structure dealers' bond or the letter of credit to be in the form approved by the director, and allows only retail customers access to the dealer's bond or the letter of credit. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact, and there's no fiscal impact. And I would like to point out that in the A. Engross bill, there was an error in the summary, and it is being corrected. The digester, when they engrossed it, removed the fact that it limits access to the dealer's bond, and so they are correcting that to restore that line.
It was in the original.
You don't have the A and Gross.
Great, and won't take an amendment.
No.
Just a correction.
Just a correction on Legislative Council.
So could we have someone from the Department of Consumer and Business Services?
They took this out.
Yeah.
Come forward. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee this morning, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Chair Hovey, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Hackett. I'm with the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I would like to offer our apologies. Mr. Tatman was delayed, and we were watching, and now I'm over here. Sorry. So the
you didn't run now, did you?
It's not far, but, you know, I need to reject it. Our division regulates manufactured structures dealers, and that's in Chapter 446. We've noticed over recent years that we've had an increasing number of problems with the manufacturer's dealers. It's a small industry, but an increasing number declaring bankruptcy, leaving buyers without homes, and we proposed a bill in the Senate to make some changes to that. The bill was amended in the Senate. We believe it's acceptable to the industry now. There are two primary provisions in the bill now. This licensing program with DCBS requires a $40,000 bond. Right now, that bond is accessible to anyone who has a claim against the dealer. The bill would make that claim available only to consumers. There are other venues for businesses to pursue fulfilling debts owed to them by the dealers, so the whole $40,000 would be available to consumers. The other change is more efficient and practical enforcement for us to deal with manufacturer structures dealers. Right now, we actually would have to issue subpoenas for it would give us authority to issue subpoenas for production of records. Currently, we would have to go through the courts to get any records from a manufactured structure dealer. So now we're proposing authority that's very comparable to other programs that the department has. In particular, we would have cease and desist orders for the manufactured structures law in 446 and could issue subpoenas for records. And the bill was drafted in the Senate. It had a provision for a client trust account for dealers to hold the money from consumers in a separate account. There was resistance from the industry, and in the Senate we removed that provision. So there is no, as Jan said, there's no fiscal and there's no opposition to the bill.
Thank you. Questions? So can you tell me a little bit more about the trust account? So how will funds be handled?
That was the, Mr. Chair, that was the provision that was removed in the Senate. Don Miner can probably speak to it more eloquently, but it was perceived to be too onerous for the limited number of dealers that still exist. But it was comparable to an attorney's client trust account where they get money from a consumer and they put it in a fund dedicated to that consumer. One of our concerns had been that money from consumer A was going to be used to pay for the construction of a manufactured structure for consumer B. So the industry is not quite ready for that kind of requirement, and nor was the Senate. So we come to you with a leaner supported bill.
So, and the monies that the consumer are paying the manufactured structure dealer are essentially for the purchase of a that we're talking about?
For the construction and or purchase. Mr. Chair, the dealers are not actually always the manufacturers. I mean, there is some overlap in that, but being a manufactured structure dealer is a unique profession and service.
So when in other real property, when there's a purchase agreement, are those monies generally held in a trust?
There's generally a reservation of the money, and some protection of the funds for a stick-built home. But we will keep discussing that provision, Mr. Chair. We'll keep discussing that provision with the industry. And
one more question. So since their money is not held in a trust, the $40,000 bond then is aimed at the consumer for not for being able to recover their investment as such. And are these investments generally less than $40,000?
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, members of the committee, a purchase can range anywhere from tens of thousands to over $100,000. So the $40,000 is a modest bond amount. Currently, if a business peer had a claim against a manufactured structure dealer, they could have up to half of that $40,000 bond. So that leaves $20,000 potentially for several consumers. $40,000 for several consumers is not the solution to a problem, but we think it's a much better use of that bond.
Thank you. Any other questions? Tim Conger.
Can you just describe, I think it's section 2 of the bill, could you describe an example of what kind of enforcement, I'm sorry, section 4, says if the director has reason to believe that a person is engaged or is engaging or is about to engage in violation of ORS 446 through 666 through 756 or rules adopted under them, the director may issue an order directed to the person to cease and desist, and then may inspect books, records, accounts, etc. It's pretty broad. Could you just briefly explain what that's aimed at and give us an example of what would be a violation that you would the department would issue a cease and desist order on?
Chair Hovey, Chair Wisnett, and Representative Conger, some of our manufactured structures dealers are located outside of the state of Oregon. It might be very difficult to get records if we got a consumer complaint about non-delivery or delayed delivery. If we wanted to investigate that, we might be required to have that out-of-state manufactured structure dealer legally be required to produce the records. The engaging in or about to engage in is fairly standard in most of our enforcement programs for our securities, our mortgage lending, those kinds of programs that we regulate. We still have to have cause, and it's still a process we have to go through. We just wouldn't have to go through the courts, for example, to subpoena those records. We could actually do a cease and desist. We would only take that kind of action if several consumers were being harmed, if there was a substantial issue and we had sort of no cooperation from the dealer.
You follow up? What's an example of something you would tell them to cease and desist from?
It might, Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, Representative Conger, it might be, recently the problems we have had are non-production of records, as well as non-production of the merchandise, essentially the home. So we might have to issue a cease and desist order so that they stopped selling to others if we had a proven record or substantial allegations that they had not been delivering the properties as they had been purchased.
May I follow up? So that would be covered under the ORS 446 sections that are referenced in the bill, that kind of activity?
Chair Wisnett, Chair Holvey, Representative Conger, yes. This gives us fairly standard for us authority to examine records. We actually don't have any of this authority right now in the Manufactured Structures Program, which Don Miner could speak to more eloquently, but it's a program that has moved around state agencies in terms of the regulator, as well as having sort of divided regulation. We have a very small part of the manufactured structures program. Our building codes program has part of it in terms of siting, but this is a program that has never had this kind of enforcement tool.
So my, I guess my only other question about process on this is, so clearly you can, the department can issue a cease and desist order that would cause a person to stop doing business. What's their process to resolve that and continue to function as a business?
Chair Holby, Chair Wisnett, Representative Conger, we have an investigation staff and we have attorneys who do our enforcement work. There are a lot of meetings with licensees or registrants before we ever would take this kind of action, unless they're unwilling to act, unless they're sort of evading us. So there would be a lot of negotiation before we would ever use this kind of authority. But we often issue a cease and desist. Often when we issue a cease and desist, there is immediate action on the part of the licensee or registrant or person who should have been licensed or registered. If they want to continue doing business, they're more likely to come to the table and discuss it with us.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Conger's question is very good, and your answers are very good and concise. But what you're saying then is you don't stop the person from doing business until you investigate. I think that's, in other words, you don't get these allegations and then stop the guy from doing business. You investigate it first before there is a appeal process or something that goes through.
And Ms. Hackett, I'm going to inform you that David Tapman's been here for quite some time, and so I thought I'd let him bail you out since you...
She's doing good.
Not that you needed bailed out, but... Mr. Tapman, if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Co-Chair Wisnett, thank you. David Tapman, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. From the outset, I want to thank Ms. Hackett for doing such an admirable job. She did far better than I would, and so I appreciate the indulgence of the committee to allow her to do that. I will say I was fairly traumatized yesterday. I just couldn't put up with coming in at 8 o'clock again because of the experience I had yesterday. Now, with all seriousness, I apologize for missing the start of this. Ms. Hackett is absolutely correct on everything she said. I just want to point out that the entire process is around our Administrative Procedures Act, Chapter 183. There's a full panoply of due process rights. And if we issue the order, it is only a notice order that tells somebody, here is what we intend to do. You have a full right to a hearing. You have a full right to have an impartial third party hear this matter and make a decision and subsequently can appeal if you're dissatisfied with that. So those are strong. American justice rights that are in place in this process. We would not take this process lightly. The process where we'd be most aggressive would be if somebody was unlicensed, and we would go in and tell them to get licensed. If they didn't get licensed, we would immediately issue an order, and then they have a right to contest that, for instance, if they felt like they didn't need to be licensed. The example that Ms. Hackett gave is probably the strongest example, and that's where we've had manufacturers, or dealers, I should say, fail to honor the commitment, and that money that was paid as a down payment went away. It wasn't necessarily used to purchase pay for the development and structuring of the home. And it's a situation like that where we would first and foremost say, get the money back to these people. And if the money wasn't forthcoming or if the person was unwilling to participate and cooperate in getting this done, then we would take this order going forward and try and resolve that. As it stands right now, we don't have that authority. It would cost us to go to the Attorney General's office, file a lawsuit, and do all the things that civil litigants have to do, which A, means a lot of cost to the state. B, it also means a real long delay in getting the process heard, short of getting a temporary injunction. So we think this is a much better way, and it still protects all the interests and rights of the potential respondent in the administrative process.
Thank you. Other questions? So, Mr. Tapman, while you're up, I guess I'll follow up with the question I sort of asked Ms. Hackett. So how do you recover the monies? I'm kind of surprised that their down payment isn't required to be in a trust account, and so it appears the down payment could be essentially commingled with the assets of the company and would make it very difficult to recover those monies back to the consumer. So how does the consumer protected in this arrangement?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, that is exactly what the original bill addressed. And what we heard was there are many, many small dealers who are doing, if you will, important work within the manufactured parks, home parks, to ensure that older models get sold and reused rather than just sit vacant and become vandalized and ultimately an eyesore. And they felt like that was just too much of a burden. For the large new dealers or for the relatively late model dealers, a fair amount of money goes into those situations. Knock on wood, we've so far been fortunate and it has only had that problem come up three times. In one instance, the actual manufacturer stepped up and did the honorable thing and actually delivered the product. In others, we were able to get the money one time, and the third time we've run into a brick wall. So that's a legitimate question that we can't always answer. We think $40,000, assuming they didn't put 100% down, in most instances they probably don't. Again, Mr. Miner will be here to testify to the amount they put down. But in most instances, maybe a $40,000 will be a significant payment towards that against the bond. We'd like to think as times get better, people will be in a better financial position to honor those commitments. But that was our grave concern, was that in difficult times, money may be misused for any number of proper or improper, well, no proper reason, but for good reason or for bad, and the trust fund made sense. It's just not something that whose time had come.
So in that $40,000 bond, though, is not for each consumer. It's for the entirety of the dealer's dealings with consumers.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We discussed raising the bond, but we felt in this economic climate that was just too much. And the fact of the matter is the cost of getting a bond is can be relatively expensive. And so if we were to take it up to $60,000 or $80,000, it was just going to be too much. Our goal is not to drive the industry underground or worse, drive it out of business. Our goal is to continue to keep this industry alive until the housing market comes back. Well, one of our goals is obviously consumer protection is one of our goals as well.
So I'll finish with this question. So on the hearings on the Senate side, it was felt that requiring a trust account was I'm having a hard time understanding how that is a negative impact to the business operations of the dealer.
I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to defer to Mr. Miner. Mr. Miner and another individual came forward and testified about the difficulties that would present. Obviously, we didn't see it exactly that way, or we wouldn't have put it in the bill in the first place. We understand that the incremental steps that we've taken with this bill were a success, and so we're willing to accept it at that. Again, they were convincing enough to say that this would be damaging to the industry. We were willing to accept that because, as I said, one of our goals is to keep this industry alive.
Very good. Appreciate that, and appreciate your testimony. We'll call up Don Miner to finish the answer. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Co-Chair Wisnett, members of the committee. I'm Don Miner. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Manufactured Housing Association to speak in support of the bill that's before you. The bond we view is a consumer bond, unlike the construction contractor's bond, that it should be limited solely to consumers. In terms of the investigatory powers the bill gives the agency, we think those are appropriate. It'll help them address any wrongdoing they may find. Mr. Chair, I assume you'd like me to answer your questions. The manufactured housing industry is a highly regulated industry in this state. It's regulated by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Every manufactured home dealer meets all the requirements of a home builder. They're subject to Construction Contractors Board process. The Department of Justice regulates their purchase agreements down to the dot and the diddle. I mean, every requirement. They specify all disclosures. In addition, they're regulated by the Building Codes Division and now the Banking Division. You know, you can heap more and more regulation on the industry, but to what end? It seems to me that there's plenty of regulation in place, and what this bill does is allow the agency to enforce existing requirements. In terms of consumer deposits, I'm out seeking bids now to have some remodeling done on one of my rentals. Every contract that I've talked to so far wants money up front. None of them are going to put that money in a trust account. If you go down and buy a car, you can pay cash up front. That money doesn't go into a trust account or an RV. There's nothing unique about this industry. Manufactured home dealers are simply merchants. If you give money to a merchant, the consumer gives money to a merchant, and that merchant fails, the consumer finds himself in the unhappy position of being an unsecured creditor, and he may or may not recover the monies that he's given to that merchant. I don't know if that addresses the concern. It's unfortunate. The economy is a train wreck out there. I think this industry has survived it relatively well. There have been some consumers injured, but and every one of them is a tragedy, particularly for that consumer. But again, there's nothing unique about this industry.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Mr. Miner, seeing no questions, I guess I'll finish with my question. And I appreciate you pointing out that construction contractors on a building project don't normally have trust accounts for their clients. I think that is true. But when you're buying real estate or a real property in a home, there's a purchase money agreement and a trust account to make sure that those deposits are accounted for and aren't commingled with other funds. So I was trying to weigh that in this situation where you are essentially buying and selling what I would call a home, and so there is a little bit of a difference there. But
Mr. Chair, if I could answer that,
I'm just wondering how a consumer is protected, you know, with their down payment on a manufactured home.
Well, Mr. Chair, manufactured homes aren't real property; they're personal property.
Mm-hmm.
It's much like going to a merchant and buying RV, a travel trailer, or a car. Manufactured home dealers are more akin to builders. They're having the consumer comes and oftentimes a home isn't in inventory. It's a home that will be built, and so the cash is given up front. That money is often given to the manufacturer, who won't begin building the house until he's paid.
Mm-hmm.
And won't release it until he's paid. So the money is held in business. It's just
so after a manufactured home is delivered and put on a foundation, is it still personal property, or does it become real property at that point?
Oregon law allows it to be converted into real property, but unless an additional step is taken, it remains personal property, except for property tax purposes. It's real property if the person who owns a home owns the land, but otherwise I think it's classified as personal property.
That's interesting. So for tax purposes it's real property, but for...
In some circumstances, if the person owns the land and the home in the same name, it's real property, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Matthews.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just a comment, I appreciate your questions on this. I find it somewhat fascinating. It seems like at times, you know, when we've talked over the years about we'll have bills that will come in and they'll be geared towards consumer protection in a certain industry, and seems like, well, now we want to be exempt, and then there's others where we've got to be included, and there just seems like I'm having a hard time drawing a line here in putting a manufactured home in the same category as a car. Mm-hmm. For me, that's a very difficult line to draw, and I think to convert it to real property is probably correct. We're talking about a home here, and I think that the manufactured home industry, I think, has a great deal of pride in what they provide. They're providing homes, and so it's tough for me to see the personal property versus real property in drawing that line, and you know, it's not in this bill today, so you and I can spend some more time talking about that, but I just find it interesting, and I appreciate the questions. I appreciate your insight to it. I understand that what we have now is a bill that is a generally consensus bill that's going to move forward. There's components of it that you like and that probably the industry needs, but there's also some things that they have backed off on as a result of the opposition that they face. So we are where we are, and again, Mr. Chair, thanks for indulging, and thanks, Mr.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might respond. If requiring merchants, manufactured home retailer to hold consumer deposits in a trust or an escrow account is a good idea, why not all merchants? Why would you single one industry out? That's a question the industry has had. It's part of the basis for objecting to that requirement. There's nothing unique about this industry. A couple Sundays ago, the Oregonian reported about a car warranty company. I think they're about $1,000, $1,500 a car. You can buy an extended warranty. That company failed. Now, each consumer only lost $1,200 or $1,500. No bonds to back it up. And in the case of the manufactured home dealer, there are two bonds. But it was thousands. So why not require all merchants to hold deposits in an escrow account? That's the question we have. It's a good public policy. It's good public policy.
Or, Mr. Chair,
yeah, Representative Matthews,
we could simply look at it from a residential standpoint and require it of all housing industries. And that would be different unless folks are living in their cars, which I understand today's situation they are.
Yeah.
But thanks for indulging, and we'll carry the conversation on beyond.
And again,
this.
Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you.
There's no similar requirement in the construction industry. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other conversations?
Do I need Cameron about when we're going to move it?
So, no other. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 85. Thank you. And we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 85.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 85 to the floor, but do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves Senate Bill 85 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, can we have a vote, please, Tamara?
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Clem.
Aye.
Representative Conger.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Vice Chair Sheehan.
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett. Aye.
No. Senate Bill 85, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. Could I have a volunteer for a carrier, please?
I think Representative Cameron wants to carry it.
I just don't want to wait to blame both of you.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Representative Cameron, would you like to vote on Senate Bill 85?
Oh, yes.
It won't change the outcome.
Yes.
And Representative Cameron votes aye on Senate Bill 85. So back to that. Is there anyone that wishes to carry Senate Bill 85? I will assign...
Mr. Chair, I'll carry it with the assistance of Mr. Miner and Mr. Tapper. Can we just get some quick speaking points on that? I'd be happy to do that for you, sir.
Thank you. Representative Matthews will carry Senate Bill 85. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 85.
Carry over.
We're going to carry over Senate Bill 908. And Representative Cameron, would you like us to suspend the rules to vote on any of these other bills before us? We have voted on all
You're
of
good.
Them.
Mr. Chair, I'm good.
You're fine.
Yeah, sorry, I had other business, but...
No, we excused you. I assumed you did, so...
I'll vote on the floor.
All right, with that, we're carrying over Senate Bill 908. We will adjourn the House Committee for General Government and Consumer Protection on Tuesday, May 10th.
Oh, jeez.